This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for joining us today. Our top story, up to 40% of homeless people in Seattle are living in their cars and vans, and the city is considering not ticketing people who live in vehicles. We're going to discuss that in just a moment. First of all, we have felt nervous in Seattle about North Korea before, right? You know they have missiles that can hit the West Coast. This week, we found out that North Korea might have figured out how to get a nuclear warhead onto one of those missiles. But we've heard threats from North Korea for years. So far, we're safe. So let's check in with someone whose job it is to be up on military threats. Congressman Adam Smith is the ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. He represents Washington's 9th Congressional District. Congressman Smith, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks for having me on.
The Washington Post reports that the Pentagon says North Korea can now get a nuclear warhead onto a long-range missile. North Korea just threatened to attack the U.S. territory of Guam. How seriously are you taking that threat?
It's a very serious threat. Now, I will say that, you know, reports in the newspapers are not necessarily accurate. I don't think anyone knows exactly where North Korea is at in terms of their capability. But make no mistake about it, you know, they've developed nuclear weapons. They are developing ballistic missiles, and they want to match the two up and be able to deliver a nuclear weapon through an intercontinental ballistic missile, and they're working towards that goal. And we have tried for 20 years through a series of negotiations, sanctions, different deals to try to dissuade them from going that route, but they're bound and determined to head there, and as such, it's a threat. But the one thing the North Korea is not, they're not suicidal. In fact, they're developing this weapons program because they believe it's necessary to ensure the survival of the regime, that it basically gives them the deterrent ability to stop us or anybody else from taking out their regime. So I don't think they're just going to launch it for no reason. And I think what we have to do is diplomatically, we have to make clear the deterrent, which is if they attack us, we have much more military capability for them than them, and if regime survival is their goal, attacking us will end their regime.
Well, isn't that what President Trump just did, made clear the deterrent?
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen.
No, he's not. There's a very important distinction. He said North Korea better not make threats, and has implied if North Korea continues to build, then we will attack them. I think that is a very dangerous message to send, and there's the huge risk miscalculation that North Korea will decide that we're going to attack them anyway, and then they launch first. What we need to make clear is that if they attack us, we will respond in a way that destroys them. To throw it out there that we might just attack them even if they don't attack us is incredibly dangerous. And the thing that I'm most worried about is that between Kim Jong-un and President Trump, there will be overheated rhetoric that leads to a miscalculation. I want both sides to stand down in terms of actually attacking. There's not a military solution here. If we attack North Korea, they have the capability of inflicting great harm on us, on South Korea, and others. What we need to make sure is that we deter them from taking military action. Throwing out threats against them that we will act just if they threaten us sends a dangerous message. I much prefer the Secretary of State's more calm message on that point.
North Korea reacted by issuing a threat, threatening to strike Guam, and the U.S. hasn't done anything yet. Does that show that the threat was empty, and are we now past that crisis point?
I hope so. And I will say that in the last couple of months, in speaking with the Pentagon and others, I've become more encouraged that they are not interested in pursuing a, you know, preemptive military approach to this. But with President Trump's rhetoric and all that, I think we have to be really careful about going down that road, because that's what worries me, is that we will think we have to act militarily first. And I don't think that's a wise course of action.
Do you hold President Obama responsible for letting us get to this point?
Look, it's been three presidents, actually, President Clinton, President Bush, and President Obama, who have all tried to deal with North Korea. And I don't blame any one of the three of them, actually. There was no easy solution here. North Korea basically decided that they were going to build a nuclear weapon no matter what. And they lied to a whole series of presidents about doing different negotiations in different places. But they were headed down this road no matter what we did. I think it's sort of 20-20 hindsight to question any one of those three presidents and say that there was something that we could have done. I mean, would we really be better off if we'd gone to war with North Korea back during the Clinton administration? I don't know. I think that's a difficult question to ask, but I wouldn't go so far as to blame the previous presidents. All four presidents here have had to deal with a very difficult situation, and the fact that it has not led to bloodshed to this point is a positive, and I hope we can continue taking that approach.
What about the argument that the U.S. has, as you said, spent years trying to negotiate and using sanctions and being less bellicose than President Trump? What about the argument that that hasn't gotten us anywhere and maybe Trump is speaking Kim Jong-un's language?
Well, I don't know that we want our president to speak Kim Jong-un's language. And again, skipping past the rhetoric and all this other stuff, there are only two very important goals here. One would be we don't want North Korea to develop this type of weapons capability. Well, that's very difficult to stop, as we've seen. But second, and I think more important, is we don't want them to use that weapons capability. And towards that end, thus far, we have been successful. And I think that needs to be the focus of our policy. How can we use our language, use our diplomacy, use our actions to be sure that North Korea is deterred from using any military capability against South Korea, Japan, or us? So it's a tricky and difficult situation, but you know, stopping the outbreak of war is the overwhelming goal here.
Congressman Smith, how seriously do you take the threat that we've heard that North Korea would prize Seattle among a top target because of military bases and population here?
Well, we actually absolutely have to take that threat seriously. And again, that's why I think we need to communicate very clearly a deterrent that any first attack by North Korea will lead to the end of their regime. And again, Kim Jong-un is not suicidal. He wants to maintain his regime. The real risk, the real danger here is in a miscalculation as the rhetoric flies back and forth. But yes, obviously, living in the Seattle area, we have to take it very seriously. But just, you know, in terms of being interested in global peace and stability, we have to take this threat very seriously.
Well, Congressman, I think we all are wondering what's going to happen next, and we're not the ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. What do you think is the most likely way this plays out?
I think the most likely way it plays out is for a very extended period of time, perhaps even decades, we have a standoff in which North Korea has weapons. They have nuclear weapons, they have missiles, but so do we. And I see it playing off as sort of a smaller version of the Cold War, that you know, North Korea will not attack us and we will not attack them because the cost would be too high for either party to do that. And hopefully we can be, you know, firm in our diplomacy and in our deterrent capability so that that's the outcome. That, yes, it's dangerous, but the attack doesn't come because both sides see the cost as too high.
I don't hear you being scared. Would you tell us if you were scared?
Let me tell you something. There is never a time when being scared is the correct and appropriate way to respond to a threat. I mean, look, you live life. I mean, I have two children. You know, my daughter goes out with her friends at night. I'm nervous. There's a million things that can go wrong in life. That's just the way it is. You have to be able to process that and not spend all your time being scared. So if you're asking me, does it make sense to be scared? The answer is always no, because it simply doesn't help you.
Adam Smith, ranking Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, U.S. Congressman from the 9th District of Washington State. Congressman, thank you for this.
Thanks. No, good interview. I appreciate the chance.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. We're on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Up to 40% of homeless people in Seattle are living in their cars and vans. the city is considering not ticketing people who live in their vehicles, not giving them tickets for parking illegally or having expired tabs. My first guest thinks this is a good idea. Professor Sarah Rankin directs the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project and teaches at Seattle University School of Law. Welcome back, Professor.
Thank you.
Why would the city not enforce its parking and licensing rules for people who are living in their vehicles?
Well, we know that it doesn't make sense to ticket people who can't pay for them. I would direct your listeners to some substantial analysis that the ACLU has conducted on debtors' prisons. And we know it doesn't make sense to ticket people who can't pay. It's not unprecedented. There are other ways that the law functions to forgive or mitigate tickets for indigent people. What we know is when we ticket people who can't pay, that practice has devastating impacts on poor and vulnerable people and really no positive benefits for society overall. We also know that there's no deterrent effect when we work with the current status quo. Our current laws really disproportionately impact and seriously damage people experiencing homelessness or vehicle residency. This results in incarceration, a surge in incarceration, and also surges of people whose cars are impounded, and then they are forced to go back out onto the street and into our overburdened, inaccessible shelter system. So we know that our current laws make people experiencing homelessness more resistant to recovery, and that results in significant costs to all of us. So some of the new considerations achieve two things. First, they mitigate harm that's suffered by our most vulnerable neighbors so that they stand better equipped to emerge from homelessness. And second, they look at seeking ways to better address the underlying causes of homelessness to all of our benefit.
Professor, is one effect then that people would be allowed to live along Seattle neighborhood streets in their vehicles?
Well, that's the reality that we're faced with right now. Well, there are a number of different recommendations that a task force is making to the City Council today. It's important to understand that when those recommendations are made, it's part of a conversation. It's part of a dialogue. There's a very broad range of people who are involved in this task force. We have people who are business owners who live in neighborhoods that are highly impacted by vehicle residency. We have people who have experienced homelessness and vehicle residency on this task force. We have lawyers, advocates, social service providers. So it's a very broad range of perspectives that are behind these recommendations. And the recommendations really focus on harm reduction and addressing the underlying causes of vehicle residency so that we can do a better job of not just serving the interests of people who are experiencing homelessness, but that we can do a better job serving the interests of public health and public safety for the whole community.
And how would parking enforcement know who is living in their car and who they will no longer give these tickets to?
Well, it's important to understand that what's under consideration right now would not just be a blanket, no one ever gets ticketed sort of situation. It's far more nuanced than that. And as I said, the recommendation is really just the beginning of a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But we know that, you can talk to folks who work in parking enforcement right now. They already know when a vehicle is likely to be used as a residence. And right now, there's really no protocol for that information to be collected anywhere.
How do they know?
Well, there's a lot of different signals. For one, they interface with these individuals all the time, and any honest officer will tell you that they know that there's no place for these people to go, no legal and safe place for these people to go, and so they often just ask them to move their cars, just for some temporary period of time, and then they see them back, within a certain, within just a few short hours. So you can look for things like evidence of living in a car.
Mm-hmm.
There sometimes can be condensation on windows, curtains that are shut, So, you know, there are all sorts of indications that many in parking enforcement are familiar with, and they generally know who when a vehicle is likely to be used as a residence.
Okay, we're talking about this idea in Seattle of letting people continue to park in a vehicle in which they live. Here opposing this idea is Scott Lindsay, a candidate for Seattle City Attorney, a former public safety advisor to the mayor of Seattle. Scott, welcome to KUOW.
Thank you for having me.
You have some experience with this. You helped start the pilot program for the safe RV zones in Seattle. What do you think of this idea?
Yeah, well, I agree with Professor Rankin that we really have a crisis on the streets of Seattle, and we have a large number of people living in their vehicles, a large number of people living in unauthorized encampments. And we also agree that we need to focus on the root causes. But I think the proposed ordinance here and some of the proposed policy solutions really are a step in the wrong direction. So I have direct experience with this. I started with the mayor, the pilot program for RV safe lots. I also worked and led and created the navigation teams. And those teams went out with police officers, engaged with people living in the most vulnerable and difficult situations. But here, what this proposed ordinance would actually do is exempt people living in vehicles from almost all of the safety regulations and parking regulations of the city of Seattle. So, for example, we don't allow people to operate junk vehicles, and that's a defined term under the Seattle Municipal Code, on the streets of the city. We don't allow them to do that because it's unsafe for the operator of the vehicle and it's unsafe for the traveling public. Anybody may be around this. They're also an environmental disaster and a real fire hazard for our Seattle Fire Department firefighters. And yet, this proposed ordinance, drafted by Councilmember O'Brien, set to be introduced next week and scheduled for a vote right now in early September, would exempt residential vehicles from that law. Now, I think that does no good for somebody who's actually living in the vehicle. It exposes them to greater danger, and it actually would have disastrous consequences for the safety of people across the city of Seattle.
Okay, then let's pause there and ask Professor Rankin, again, as one of the people advocating to the city council on this idea. Professor, you've already told us that there are a lot of proposals and ideas, and it all might change, but are you in favor of allowing people to operate this official term, junk vehicles, in the city of Seattle?
I think there's a real danger in speaking in generalities, and I think it's also important for us to be really, really clear what we're talking about here, because there is no proposed ordinance out there right now. What Mr. Lindsay is referring to is actually not an ordinance at all. I've seen some public comment from him, but it was on something that was a very early draft that, as I understand it, from the city, in that form that he commented on, will never be proposed in that form nor considered by the city council.
So, okay, so living in junk vehicles won't happen?
What is really important for us to understand is that the when we talk about a proposed ordinance, there is not a proposed ordinance on the table.
Yeah.
And so we really, really, really need to be careful with that. What I can tell you is that the recommendations that the Vehicle Residency Task Force, that multi, you know, sort of disciplinary task force that I'm a part of, has looked at studies, including what the failures were with our earlier efforts to create safe lots. What we're recommending are a variety of approaches, including better data collection, a comprehensive needs assessment. We think that the city should fund and systematize more targeted outreach. We've
okay.
Got
so,
a couple of
Professor, I know you're studying the issue, and as you said, we don't know what's going to be in the final recommendations and all that. I just wanted to so that listeners can follow what we're talking about. We have, let me ask Scott, we have more unsheltered people than we have low barrier housing than they want to go into. Shouldn't we be looking at even temporary ways to help people at least have some sort of shelter? They're in a car, they're out of the elements.
Absolutely. And that's why I helped with the creation of the Navigation Center. I helped with the creation of authorized encampment locations across the city. Those are regulated, safe, and well-managed. But here's the problem. Supporting people living in their vehicles is the most expensive and least productive, least efficient way to actually help people get out of homelessness.
Why would it be the most expensive? They have the car.
Well, they have the car, but in order to do it in a sanitary, a healthy, and a safe way, the city actually, and on city managed property, the city actually has to provide substantial services. So that's basic sanitation, that's water, that's porta-potties, case management, security, very often. All of those things cost money. So we attempted to do this.
That's right. There were RV lots, safe lots.
We put together a pilot program, established 3 RV safe lots and 3 RV safe zones to experiment with different models. And here's what we found. The total cost of one of those lots with 20 vehicles was $36,000 per month for 20 vehicles. Okay, that's in effect $1,700-$1,800 per month per vehicle, or in other words, the cost of actually putting that person up into housing. In order to support somebody in an authorized encampment, the costs are a tenth of
that. Okay, it's expensive. So then let me ask Professor Rankin, what about the idea of not allowing continued parking on neighborhood streets, but something less expensive than the safe lots we just heard about? Let's say parking lots where you can be, but without all the services, electricity, water. Is there some middle ground here?
About trying to be really clear about nuance.
Yeah.
The recommendations are not like a cleaver. We have a variety of recommendations. Some of those include recommendations that there be stable, staffed, safe parking lots. And then there's areas called safe zones. We can build on the failures and the experiences of the early safe parking lots. We've done a better job of addressing and identifying what the best practices are, ways that we can do this more cost effectively. And if we take the recommendations of the task force, we should be able to provide more targeted services and outreach to people who need it, more targeted provision of hygiene services and waste removal, and at the same time come up with pathways that will allow for people to actually emerge from homelessness and become more self-sufficient. So all of these sorts of approaches require us to have a much better grasp on what's happening with vehicle residency. Our current approach really facilitates a very fragmented, sort of hysterical approach to vehicle residency. We need to have a much more coherent approach, and that's part of what the task force is recommending.
Okay, Professor, if there are places for people who live in their cars to park outside the city and not get troubled because it's just not so crowded, parking areas and places along the street are not in as high demand, why not enforce the laws in city limits, knowing that there are easier places for people to park who live in vehicles?
Well, as I mentioned before, it depends on what you mean by enforce the laws. None of the proposals that the task force is making would require the city to prioritize the interest of a homeless person over a real public health or public safety issue. None of them. But instead, we really need to think about what sorts of laws we're talking about enforcing. Ticketing, as I mentioned before, when someone can't pay it, has really no positive impacts. These don't have a deterrent effect. They don't result in a significant collection of revenue. They just harm people and make them more resistant to recovering from homelessness.
Okay. And Scott, as Professor Rankin said, we already have people living in their cars, and we've said we don't have a place for everyone to go. How does this? Why not just recognize the fact that some people you impound their car, now they don't even have that, or you pile tickets on them, they can't pay that.
Yeah.
How do we solve that issue?
So the city of Seattle actually has a very successful program called Scofflaw Mitigation that helps people in exactly this circumstance. And Professor Rankin hasn't mentioned that, but that's an important piece of how the city responds, which is we say, yeah, everybody has to obey the basic parking laws of the city. But if as a result of an unfortunate incident, say your starter breaks and you can't move your vehicle, you get a ticket, then the Scofflaw Mitigation team helps you avoid that ticket or pays that ticket for you and also provides assistance with the repair of the vehicle. That's the way that we keep people and support people in living in vehicles. But I don't feel that Professor Rankin and Councilmember O'Brien are being fully honest. There is an ordinance that is in draft form. It's dated August 4th, 2017.
Okay, but that's what we're debating right now.
It would exempt these vehicles
yeah.
fully from the law.
A draft ordinance, right? So this right. is all being studied, and as we've said, studied and debated. Sarah Rankin, is there a question of fairness here? Because I could imagine, I sometimes get emails like this from someone who might be listening now saying, you know, someone who lives in their car is getting some kind of special consideration.
Absolutely. And I just want to mention something just real quickly. Mr. Lindsay mentioned the Scofflaw mitigation team. There's also a program called Road to Housing. These are severely either non-funded or underfunded programs, and that's one of the recommendations that we're making, is to fund and better systematize some of the successful programs that are being done. You mentioned, is it unfair? I really think this is important, and it's something that you often hear is, why can't we just ticket these people? It's so important to understand that when you assess fines and penalties on people who can't pay them, it doesn't serve as a meaningful deterrent. As long as they don't have a reasonable alternative to living in their vehicle, you know, one that isn't living on the street, you can ticket the heck out of them, and it's not going to change the fact that they still need to live somewhere legally. And if you take their vehicle away, they will live on the street or, as I mentioned before, tax our overflowing shelters. And there's another piece to all of this that I think is really important to call out. I think there's a certain short-sightedness that we get from privilege. It's short-sighted and erroneous to perceive these sorts of harm mitigation efforts as granting special rights to people experiencing homelessness or somehow to a disadvantage of housed people. It's just not true. For many people who get a parking ticket, this means we're going to be upset and angry and we'll pay for it without major consequence to our lives and to our communities. What we know is that when people who are experiencing poverty and homelessness are hit with these sorts of tickets, the impact can be absolutely life-altering. And when that happens, it's not just an impact on people experiencing homelessness, but it taxes us. It creates more costs to all of us because they're going to be incarcerated, their vehicles will be impounded, they'll be forced onto the street. So what's fair, what is really best, is to think of this not in terms of fairness, are there different rules for different people, because our judicial system already allows for indigency waivers in a lot of different contexts. So that's not new. But what is fair is thinking about how important it is to address the underlying causes of homelessness and vehicle residency, because it will address all of our interests, not just the interests of people experiencing homelessness, but the interests of our entire community.
Okay, Professor Sarah Rankin directs the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project and teaches at Seattle University School of Law. I gave her the first word. Final word, Scott Lindsay. What about compassion and thinking about what's fair to people in the bigger picture?
Yeah, I obviously think that we need to be very compassionate, and the city of Seattle needs to do much more and focus much more on these issues. But again, some of these recommendations are in the wrong direction. For example, you know, 55% of the folks living in Seattle and King County as homeless are actually people of color, yet only a tiny fraction of the total number of people living in vehicles or RVs are people of color. And yet what Professor Rankin and Councilmember O'Brien are proposing is to dedicate significant resources to supporting people living in their vehicles when we know that that is the most inefficient way to spend those resources. It would also divert those resources away from traditional services for the homeless that actually serve a more representative sample of the population. And I need to say here, Bill, that we have to recognize that these vehicles often put real strain on the neighborhood streets of Seattle. If you're living in your vehicle, very often you are dumping your waste into the planting strip in front of the vehicle. You are dumping your debris into the planting strip in front of your vehicle. If you take any tour of SoTo or Lower Ballard or Interbay right now, you are going to see hundreds of examples of that. And many people with multiple...
But that can happen now, but you're saying it'll be more spread out across the city?
It would be more spread out across the city because right now, vehicles, oversized vehicles, RVs, are not allowed to park in residential or commercial areas overnight.
Okay, and that's what we've been talking about. Pardon me, the idea of Seattle allowing more parking Giving people compounding tickets for parking illegally, having expired tabs. This is all in motion. It's being studied. It's being debated. That's why we're talking about it right now. And Professor Sarah Rankin with the Homeless Rights Advocacy Program will be making recommendations today to the City Council. Thank you, Professor. And Scott Lindsay, candidate for Seattle City Attorney, former public safety advisor to the mayor of Seattle. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
KUOW's The Record, back in just a moment. Join our conversation on Twitter at KUOW. This is The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Higher anxiety and lower stress tolerance. Those are a couple of reasons why former Google engineer James Damore believes women can't excel in tech the way men can. As you've probably heard, over the weekend, Damore wrote this 10-page so-called manifesto criticizing Google's diversity efforts. He also railed against what he sees as Google's political bias. He called the culture there an ideological echo chamber. We have a big Google office and, of course, other big tech companies here. This is relevant to us in Seattle. Google fired Damore after the memo went viral. We want to talk now to tech reporter April Glazer, who covered this story for Slate. April, welcome to KUOW.
Thanks. Great to be here.
So you cover this industry. Were you surprised by the memo?
I was shocked because of what it said, but no, I was not surprised.
What about other Google employees coming out in, not all by any means, but there were some voices of support from Google workers. What did you make of that?
Sure. I mean, what that represented was that Damore, the man who wrote the memo, was actually reflecting a sentiment that many people at Google adhere to. Of course, most of the people at Google's response to this has been negative and have thought that his comments were abhorsive. That said, there's certainly a contingent of people who work throughout Google that thought that women are biologically inferior to men when it comes to tech positions.
And April, you have said that it was tech culture that emboldened this man enough to write something like that. What do you mean by that?
Well, there is a culture at tech companies that values free speech and that often gets valued above the moral obligation of these companies to protect the safety of their employees and of the communities that they manage online as well. And, you know, we see people on Twitter getting harassed off Twitter all the time for racist and misogynistic comments. Likewise on Facebook, we see a disproportionate amount of African-American activists getting their posts removed from the platform. This is something that happens a lot, where the free speech of people takes precedent over the safety of the community.
What, are you saying that free speech ethic has a special character in tech companies?
It does. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that these platforms have been allowed to flourish because of a law called the Communications Decency Act that was passed in the 90s that essentially says that tech companies are not responsible for what's posted on their platform. And this has allowed them to, you know, be safe from a lot of lawsuits and has allowed these platforms to grow, in very large, quick ways and has given them the legal cover that they need to take those big investments to grow. But that culture of free speech, that these companies aren't necessarily responsible for what people say, is also permeating the workforce. And that's a community that they do have control and responsibility over.
Google's leader of diversity and inclusion, Danielle Brown, told you that this employee advanced incorrect assumptions about gender, but also that Google needs to foster inclusivity, that there needs to be space for different political views. How did you react to that?
Well, you know, it's certain that people with different political views can work alongside each other. And it's certainly possible for people with, fringe conservative beliefs to say that the diversity initiatives at Google aren't working or that they're pointless. That's totally different than flat out saying, counterfactual, that making counterfactual arguments about, a woman's biological ability to get the job done. And that's quite different than making arguments that also make people feel unsafe working there. So if I was working on an engineering team at Google and I knew that some of my colleagues that I was working with agreed with this manifesto, with this man's memo, that I wasn't suited for the job because of my biology, how could I ever work alongside him, right? That sounds like a horrible place to work. So there's a difference between, speaking respectfully about differences in political opinion and having a safe place for discourse that fosters conversation that doesn't necessarily harm people.
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying this isn't just a matter of respect, but there's a workplace problem that this guy just told a class of employees that he can't impartially judge them, which I don't know about all big tech companies, but Google employees have a peer review system.
Sure, and he should have never felt, many big tech companies do, and he really should have never felt emboldened to post this in the first place, right? The fact that he felt confident enough to share these views meant that he knew other people agreed with him, most likely, and it also means that that he knew that his speech was more protected than perhaps the safety of the people that work at the company. And this post was left up for days and was allowed to circulate and go viral. You know, another response that Google could have made would have been to take it down immediately and said that this is unacceptable and we're not going to have this.
We're talking with Slate's tech reporter April Glazer. What could he have done differently, April? This engineer called Google an ideological echo chamber where some ideas are too sacred to be discussed honestly. He called the lack of discussion extreme and authoritarian. How could he have expressed his views in a better way?
Well, if he disagreed with the diversity efforts at Google, he could have said that he thought the diversity efforts at Google were futile and that they should focus on engineering. And of course, that would have been incredibly offensive to a lot of people, but it would have been a very, very different and engendered in a completely different tone of conversation than saying that they're futile because women are biologically inferior.
Okay,
there are ways to have political debate.
Okay, saying that... there's a way to say that your company's diversity goals are misplaced without having that workplace problem we said about basically telling a class of people that you don't value or recognize their contributions?
Not just value and recognize their contributions, but that you believe that they're biologically inferior.
Did he say biologically inferior?
He specifically said, and I quote, "I'm simply stating that the distribution of preferences and abilities of men and women differ in part due to biological causes, and that these differences may explain why we don't see equal representation of women in tech and leadership." So if I am not capable of because of my biology of taking a leadership role at Google, I consider that to be a statement of saying women are inferior.
Yeah, well, he's clearly saying that women's biology works against them in tech. It's not quite the same as judging them biologically inferior, right?
Well, that men are better suited for some things than others, it means inherently that women are less suited.
Mm-hmm. We have, as I mentioned, April, a big Google office in Seattle, a lot of other tech companies here, as you know, Amazon, Microsoft, et cetera. What do you think we ought to learn from this story? Certainly, I mean, this guy, you could have just dismissed this person, but this has gotten so much attention. What are we learning?
I think what we're learning is that, that there's obviously people who agree with him that work in tech and that this mindset, at these big tech companies that make the products that we rely on to communicate with each other, to get news and information, to participate meaningfully in a democracy and in our communities, that people who have this mindset, that actually seeps often into product design. And we see that, for instance, in 2015 when Google had a photo algorithm that mislabeled black people as gorillas, right? You know, who knows why that happened, but there has to be a question of, is that if there was a more diverse team, would that have happened, right? And we also see, that this type of sexism, it might spring up through like disrespecting colleagues or, hiring practices and things like that. I mean, sure, he might feel this way and be free to express the way he feels, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't manifest in all of these awful ways that we can't even see, right? And in all likelihood, he might point to biological causes that prevent women from being successful engineers, but he or someone with similar views might have been the variable in preventing women from actually getting those leadership roles.
Interesting. It sounds like you're saying, we may think of New York as, hey, New York, you're a media center, and Hollywood, you're a center of culture, but that maybe in Silicon Valley and in Seattle, you're also talking about these kind of companies that we have in our cities have maybe an outsized role. It's not just about gadgets.
Well, sure, the design decisions that they make, mediates how we communicate with each other. And if the people who are making those design decisions, think sexist or racist things, then that can certainly seep into the product. You know, we see that likewise with Google search. A few years ago, when you searched for three white teenagers, you saw happy, smiling kids holding sports balls. When you searched for three black teenagers, you see mugshots. This is a decision. This is a product, and that maybe would not have happened in a more diverse team. And Google's diversity numbers, by the way, as are many other tech companies, are abysmal. Its tech team is only 1% black. It's been 1% black since 2014 when it started sharing its diversity numbers, and it still is today, despite the fact that Google has been spending millions on diversity efforts. So there was a real question as to whether or not the diversity and inclusion efforts and the unconscious bias trainings, as they put it, have really been done with a full heart, hoping to fix this problem, or if there's simply an effort to kind of paper over an issue and appease people who are complaining about diversity at the company.
We've been talking about a former Google engineer who no longer has a job, at least for now, and his 10-page rant or manifesto. And we've been talking about it with April Glazer, a tech reporter for Slate Magazine. And April, we'll link here on Twitter at KUOW. We'll send out a link to your piece at Slate. Thanks for the time.
Thanks so much.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Back in a moment. There are thousands of asylum seekers coming from the United States into Canada, and we're going to be talking in a moment about some of the reaction in Canada to that situation. President Trump's rhetoric on immigration and race and gender has left a lot of Americans worried and determined. KUOW's poetry correspondent Elizabeth Austin has brought in a poem that was written soon after Trump's inauguration.
It's been ricocheting around in me ever since I read it on the website Seattle Review of Books back in March. Vigilant is one of several poems that Jamaica Baldwin wrote just after the inauguration, but this one gives voice to an emotional reaction that's both larger than that single event, and it's also more and more relevant with each fresh newscast.
Okay, this is Jamaica Baldwin. We're about to hear her read, and I want to let you know that about a minute into this poem, there is language that some listeners might find offensive.
This poem is titled Vigilant. It's hard to remain human on a day when mercy is a frozen river, when the news informs me tomorrow's as bleak as it was yesterday, tells me yesterday couldn't have left love lingering listlessly on my bed, all eager hands and doe-eyed, says there's no room for beauty in this fight. Liberals tell me we must remain vigilant. We can't rest, relax, let down our guard. But don't they know I've been vigilant all my life, yielding to white spaces like ocean to keel? I was vigilant when, in high school, white friends proclaimed, "I don't see color," then painted their bodies with sun as if skin were a lipstick they could apply to the perfect shade of not too dark. These days it's disguised in praise like, "What a beautiful mix you are," as if to say, "Be grateful you're not as black as you could have been." I've vigilantly guarded my mind around men who only valued my body, guarded my body from men who think permission is for pussies, who think a fistful is a proper unit of measurement. When the cab driver told me I must have a white parent because I don't sound black, I vigilantly wrapped myself in my arms, tried to imagine the sounds he'd make without vocal cord or tongue or his privilege. Each time someone cracks a joke about a black man's disproportionate prowess, about a black man's laziness, about a black boy's good-for-nothing father, I want to vigilantly cradle my grown brother in my arms and sing him something soft and sweet to keep his fists steady and his mind right. But what right do I have keeping him in check when they don't take the time to check their ignorance? We try our best not to, but sometimes a woman must walk down a dark street alone, must count the number of parked vans, must keep to the middle of the road, must stay out of reach, must keep her eyes peeled, must walk with wide steps, grab her crotch like a man, spit like a man. Things they teach girls in self-defense, must turn herself into something a man would never desire, must be masculine, be careful, be vigilant. So when liberals say, this is how we fight back, this is how we'll win, I want to tear my clothes off, walk naked into rush hour traffic, cut my feet on broken glass and car fragments, breathe in exhaust fumes, let the poison sink into my skin, grow an extra limb, heart, head, become something unneutered, volatile, dangerous, become something able to withstand the next 4 years.
That's Jamaica Baldwin reading the poem Vigilant. And Elizabeth, why did you choose this poem today?
I think because it captures a conversation that is happening in many places, particularly here in liberal Seattle.
Right. She doesn't say Seattle, but it's relevant here.
I think so. But particularly because it's in the form of a poem has a kind of amplitude that is bigger than an editorial or a rant. And it's signaled right there in the beginning with the way she uses imagery. So the one that I keep coming back to is, we can't rest, relax, let down our guard, but don't they know I've been vigilant all my life, yielding to white spaces like ocean to keel. Think about that image of ocean to keel. It has a sense of vastness of the ocean, but lurking in that image is also an image of slave ships.
Oh.
So it's that kind of layering that gives a poem the kind of staying power, which is why I have kept thinking about it since I first read it in March and wanted you to hear it.
Images that stick with you. This is why we bring poetry to you on KUOW. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Again, Jamaica Baldwin reading Vigilant, and that poem was originally published online by the Seattle Review of Books. Elizabeth Austin is our poetry correspondent, and you'll find a link to the text of that poem and audio of more of Jamaica Baldwin's poetry at KUOW.org. KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. When is this smoky haze going to lift? The burn ban is back in effect. No campfires, no fire pits. You can't even barbecue with charcoal in King or Pierce or Kitsap or Snohomish counties until the wind shifts or the fires go out. So let's go to the source. In British Columbia, Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Vaughn, I realize we sound whiny complaining about smoke when you've got the fire. You're in a state of emergency. How's the firefighting going?
British Columbia's, state of emergency. It's been going on for a month now. 1.5 million acres of British Columbia have been burned this year. It's a record. You have to go back to the 1950s to find anything like this, and it's still early in the season. We've got almost 1,000 forest fires altogether and more added every day. So it's pretty bad. Almost 4,000 people fighting the fires here in British Columbia, and we're relying on our neighbors and some people who aren't even neighbors, like Australia and New Zealand. We're bringing in people from New Mexico to help fight it, but it's bad. In terms of the smoke, and we're getting it here, I'm in Victoria, the provincial capital, and the sky's overcrowded, but they're saying the wind by the end of the week should start clearing off some of the smoke. The fires, you know, what can you say? We're in the Lord's hands on it. It's they've had a lot of success putting out a lot of fires, and happily there's been no loss of life, and much of it has been confined to the forest, not to towns and people's homes. But we'll be talking about this year in British Columbia and forest fires for a long time to come.
Yeah, no loss of life is great to hear. How are the fires affecting the people of British Columbia?
Well, the air quality problem is huge in some towns in British Columbia. I know I do a weekly thing on the radio station in Kamloops in the south central interior of British Columbia, and they've had you know, health alerts, respiratory problems. The particles from the fire, the soot particles, are so small that they're the kind that lodge in your lungs and stay there. So if you have respiratory problems or asthma, You can be coughing for a long time after this. I know you hear anecdotally that people have left their communities and gone somewhere else because of the smoke problem. That's the other thing. You know, we get a state of emergency here in British Columbia in a bad year, Bill. It'll be a couple of weeks. But this thing has been going on a month. The government just extended it again. You still have thousands of people on either who've either been evacuated for their community or on their alert to be ready to go within 24 hours. So, no, this is... And the running tab for fighting all of this is $250,000 Canadian already, and that's a preliminary number. It'll be a lot more than that by the time the government's done with it.
Okay, there you go, Puget Sound area residents. I hope you don't have asthma or other lung problems, but that does put things in perspective, the report from British Columbia. Here in Washington State, we just have, I checked yesterday, four officially active wildfires and only one of them over 3,000 acres just below the border in Washington State for some reason. Vaughn, on another topic, some Canadians I see are sounding alarm bells about all the asylum seekers, thousands of asylum seekers coming the other direction from the United States into Canada. Will you remind us why that's going on?
Well, there's two things happening at once, really. The first is a lot of people, the kind of people that are coming here and seeking refugee status are obviously people that are very, very vulnerable. For example, there's a large number of people that came to the United States from Haiti following the earthquakes and all the tragedies there. And because of the kind of rhetoric that's been coming from your president, they've gotten alarmed. The community's gotten up in arms, and you've had hundreds of people come north from that community. They go to the province of Quebec because people from Haiti speak French, and if you speak French, you have an easier chance of getting into Quebec. I know they've activated the old Olympic Stadium in Montreal, which used to be the home to the Montreal Expos when they were playing baseball. They're using it as a shelter for the Haitians. And right across Canada, you're getting... You know, the numbers are still in the hundreds. They're not in the thousands, but they're people that come to the border, present themselves, seek asylum, seek refugee status in Canada, because they don't believe they'll be able to get it in the United States, and because they do believe they'll be able to get it in Canada.
Yeah, what happens to the asylum seekers?
Well, essentially, if you can get in, you get to stay. There's... social safety net, there's reluctance to return them. We have an agreement with the United States that people are supposed to apply for asylum in the country they arrive in. It's a reciprocal agreement. So if you arrive in the United States, you're supposed to apply there. And if you arrive in Canada, you're supposed to apply there. But what's been happening is people have been entering Canada illegally. They've been walking across some part of the border where... There's no guarding. They've been hiring essentially people smugglers who help them get across the border, and then they get here and they apply for refugee status, and generally we don't return them. So it's been building up. The government says they can handle the influx. They say, Bill, that it's not a huge number of people compared to our resources, that these are hardship cases, that we're not going to return them. We're not going to strand them, but even advocates of refugees and of migrants are saying that the backlog is growing. The government can say it can help them and deal with them, but its resources are not sufficient to do that. So either the government is going to have to beef up the resources and start processing people more quickly, or you're going to start to have encampments. As I say, this one in Montreal where they've got them in the Olympic Stadium there is the most recent one, and I guess the most obvious one, but the concern across the country is there'll be more like this if the government doesn't do something to, as I say, either stem the tide or start putting the resources into the system that are needed to process all these people.
That's Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer filling you in on asylum seekers heading from here to there and the fires bringing smoke from there to here. Vaughn, always good to talk with you. Thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill. Hope it's a better week next week.
Indeed. Let's talk about a better week next week. Finally, some news for Mariners fans. The M's won yesterday, so now they're tied for the second wild card spot. They're tied with two other teams, and there's another five close behind, but it's something. And the Mariners are number one in something, food safety. Sports Illustrated just ranked all the Major League stadiums on food safety complaints and found Safeco Field has America's best ballparks when it comes to food safety. Go M's.